anybody who's at the show yesterday, do we actually go through the daf or just talk about things on the daf? Well, what happened yesterday is
that we spoke about. Wasn't just reading the Gemara, it was seeing a sheet.
Wasn't actually reading through the daf. Okay, so let's do it like that also. Wasn't sure if it was like a daf-yomi model. Okay, so basically we could talk about in a general sense some of these topics. Just to mention one thing that comes up before the daf really starts. So we know that the perek is about the bedikos and the chakiros, about the different reasons, the different questions that were asked, the chakiros being more fundamental questions that have a greater consequence and that you can't opt out of. The Gemara on our daf ultimately explains that you can't opt out of a chakira because we have to be able to establish the edus based on the chakira and establish the possibility for hazama. So if you have one party opting out of the chakiros, so then you have edus shia tayochol hazima. While bedikos are less crucial to the process, and they're part of what the dayanim could utilize in order to establish the situation. And we find different degrees of intensity of these questions in general. There are those, there's some sources that imply, for example, the Mishnah in Makas on Daf Tes, which discusses how frequently a Bezdin should execute someone. And the suggestion appears there that a Bezdin shouldn't execute once every 7 years, then maybe not even once every 70 years, otherwise they'd be considered to be a murderous Bezdin, a bloody Bezdin. So how do you avoid that? So if you have people who are committing crimes, so how do you avoid executing them? So Rashi explains that the position that says that you shouldn't kill too often would involve really driving the Edom crazy. Then if you ask enough questions that they can't answer, so then you can create a situation where you don't have to accept anybody's edus, which seems to suggest that really it's up to the dayanim to decide whether they find the testimony credible or not, and if they don't, they can act more intensely in their questioning and prevent the edus from being accepted. In general, nowadays there's a lot of discussion about just how reliable eyewitness testimony is, so presumably that's also a part of it, that Chazal were aware that there has to be a very intense questioning process, or at least the potential of a very intense questioning process, because if you don't have that, then you could have some very serious mistakes. And in general, you find that we're very careful about that, that Chazal didn't take a casual attitude towards executing people. In general, that's worth a little bit of an introduction, that the question of what exactly is the role of capital punishment within the halachic system. And it's also relevant, maybe we could point out some things on this daf specifically. You may ask, let's say, if you're a member of, if you're a citizen of the United States, so they ask you, so what does the Torah hold about capital punishment? Should we have capital punishment in America? So they might say, well, look, you know, the Torah is full of capital punishment. So what does that tell you? That maybe we should have capital punishment. On the other hand, we also sometimes find these attitudes that we were very hesitant to impose capital punishment, and that these questions were used sometimes in order to make it very difficult to impose capital punishment. So some have the attitude, which might be true, that the hashkafa of the Torah in terms of the death penalty is that the death penalty should be on the books, and it should be there as a potential deterrent. But in practice, we should be very hesitant to ever impose it. Maybe we should almost never impose it. And that's essentially what the Mishnah is telling us, the Mishnah in Makkah. So that could be true. But you have to figure out. It's a little bit difficult because we have different contexts. That when the Gemara talks about executing someone, so we have at least three different settings. We have the Sanhedrin executing when all the details are in place, and that's what's described in a lot of this context. We also have, on the other end of the spectrum, we have the din of Bnei Noach, and that's Gemara later on in Masechet Sanhedrin, that Bnei Noach are mitzvah and dinim, and that presumably has a different set of rules in terms of how you impose punishment. And in the middle, there is a concept that many pointed out, the Ran most famously in his drushes and others as well, that let's say within the Jewish system, if you have somebody who's running around hurting people, running around killing people, but make sure to do so without the proper edim. So how are you going to stop such a person, right? Because it's very hard to get executed under this system, as we'll see. So how are you going to stop somebody who's running around hurting people if they don't have two kosher edim, and they don't have hasra, and they don't have the like? So there's this in-between concept called the Mishpat HaMelech, that the king has the authority to keep the peace, has to do what he has to do in order to keep people safe. And that could be carried out by the Sanhedrin, it could be carried out by the Melech. It's really a function of the Melech, a function of protecting people. And therefore, that was an in-between way to deal with people who were running around posing a danger to society. So we have essentially three different systems. We have the full-blown Sanhedrin system with Edom and with Hasra and with all of that, which is pretty hard to actually get convicted under that system. You have to hire a fancy lawyer to get yourself convicted because it's not so easy. And we have the in-between, we have the Mishpat HaMelech, and you have the Din of Bnei Noach, which is a different story. There was a whole discussion in the 1950s, in the early days of the Medina, in Israel, there was a whole discussion about whether Israel should have capital punishment now that there was a Jewish government. So the chief rabbinate was consulted at the time, and they thought that we can't really have a capital punishment because we don't have a full-blown Sanhedrin. All we have is Mishpat HaMelech. That way we have a Jewish government, but we don't have all of the necessities. Our Gemara talks about how the fact that right before the Churban HaBayis, 40 years before the Churban HaBayis, that's Nardaf also, so the Sanhedrin was exiled from the Lishkar HaGazis, and therefore they didn't any longer carry out capital punishment. So too, in 1950, that was also the case. They didn't have a functioning Sanhedrin. So the only context in which they could execute somebody would be if it was based on Mishpat HaMelech. And Mishpat HaMelech is presumably motivated by protecting society. And they understood, or they assumed, that if you put somebody up in jail forever, if you lock somebody in jail forever, so then that'll protect society, and there's no need to execute anyone. So they thought there wasn't a justification for capital punishment under contemporary circumstances, and that's been the policy of the government of Israel. They only give the death penalty to Nazi war criminals, that's it, and nobody else. Now there's a whole debate, maybe it should be brought back because of issues of terrorism, and that's a particularly relevant question, whether or not it's possible to protect the populace with just life imprisonment or something along those lines.
Begin used to lead rallies.
Sorry?
Begin used to lead rallies to give the death penalty.
Oh yeah? Okay. So it's a conversation that's still going on today, long after Begin, and it has to do with this question. It's interesting, the whole idea of Misas Bezdin, so we know it's a mitzvah. Torah says that under some circumstances you have to execute somebody. So the question is, how many mitzvahs is it? Which is not what strikes us as the most interesting question. You'd think, like, what difference does it make? But there might be a philosophical difference, because there is a Machlokas HaRishonim about this, that there were those who felt that it's all one mitzvah. The Ramban was of the opinion, there's one mitzvah in the Torah of Hubi'arta Haram Mikrebecha. All the Mitzvahs Bezdin were all included under that. And the Ramban thought that there were four mitzvahs. Why should there be four mitzvahs? Because there are four methods of execution. Skila, Sreifa, Harag, Chenek, he counted each one of those as a separate Mitzvahs Bezdin. And then you have the Bahag, who went to the other extreme of the Ramban. The Baha'i counted every single time the Torah gives a Chiyuv Misa for something, he counted that separately. So it sounds like a very technical debate. Does it matter whether we count it as one mitzvah, we count it as four, we count it as dozens of mitzvahs, does it matter? So the truth is, it might be that there is a hashkafic difference there, that one could ask, you know, what is the point of Misas Bezdin? What is the thrust of Misas Bezdin? So let's say, for example, let's talk about the concept of punishment in general. So let's say I'm teaching a class. Question about that?
If you know there are all distinct mitzvahs, how are you allowed to give the other mitzvahs to people who are chayav one mitzvah, for example?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there are some essays about that in some of the Achronim, trying to figure out whether they can be included with each other. And you could ask a better question, I think, before that, which is a little bit what we want to address here, is why is that significant? You know, why is it... I could hear the Ramban's opinion that everything is all part of one big mitzvah of Biartu HaMikvecha, and you could hear the Bahag's view also, because each one, theoretically, is a separate concept. But what's the relevance of grouping things just in terms of execution method. You know, why?
Can you just be machlokas in terms of mini mitzvahs? Like,
yeah, but what's that machlokas about? Why do they count it like that?
Meaning just because their cheshbon had to have it come out correctly?
Also, see, they're forcing the numbers into the system. Well, that's not such a fun way to look at it. I'd like to believe a little bit more to it. It's very academic. But we'll try to assume there might be a little bit more concept behind it, that it could have to do with the question of what is the purpose of punishment in the halachic Beis Din system. That, let's give you an example. We'll talk about punishment. So let's take a little more mundane example. So let's say I have a class, and a student's talking. So I throw the student out of the class. I've never actually done this. But let's say it happened, right? So I throw a student out for talking. So why did I do that? So you might say, because I can't teach if he's talking. Right? That if he's going to talk, then I'm going to have a disruptive classroom. So in order to teach, I have to take out this distraction. I have to remove the student from the class. That's one possible reason. It might be that that's no problem for me to teach while he's talking. I'm more interesting than he is. No one's going to listen to him. They'll listen to me. But the problem is that I'm worried about him. That if I let him keep talking and nothing happens, so then he's going to think that he can just talk and do whatever he wants and break rules to whatever degree he wants. And he'll end up becoming a terrorist because he'll just break rules for the rest of his life, and I can stop him from becoming a terrorist by throwing him out right now. So for his own good. A third reason might be, maybe I'm not worried about the class, they can pay more attention to me, and I'm not worried about him, I'm a substitute teacher, so I don't care what happens to him. But I'm worried about the law, that if we have a sign on the wall that says no talking, and he can talk and nothing happens, so then the law doesn't mean anything. So for the law to mean something, it has to be backed up by some kind of a system, and maybe that's the reason. So that gives us three different theories of why you might punish someone, that either to protect society, because society can't function when this person is there, or for the good of the criminal himself, because we want to rehabilitate him. Now, in the context of the death penalty, it sounds a little funny to talk about rehabilitation, except that from a religious perspective, there is such a thing, because we believe there is a world beyond this one, so there is a kapara that comes from Misa. So theoretically, you could have a rehabilitation, you could have death penalty for the good of the sinner. And the third perspective is really for the good of the law. The law has to be protected, has to be supported, and that's what punishment is for. So in that case, we could suggest that the Rambam is arguing with Ramban and the Bahag basically on this point, that the Ramban says that we punish for the good of society. All we care about is that society should not have this danger within it, whether it's a physical danger or a spiritual danger. We have to protect society from that. So we get rid of that. That's the Ramban, perhaps. The Rambam, who focuses on the four misos, so what's the significance of the four different misos? So that we see on Ardaf too. So Ardaf talks about the machlokis that existed among the Amoraim as to whether a skila is more chamer than Shrefer, a Shrefer is more chamer than skila. Whatever the details are, there's different gradations of severity among the misos bezdin. So essentially, the reason to give one miso or the other is because there's a greater need for a kapara, that one misa gives a level A kapara, another misa gives level B kapara, C and D. So essentially what the Torah is saying is that certain sinners need level A, certain need level B, certain need level C, and that's why the Rambam's counting each one distinctly. So to answer your question, it could be that if we can't give the full kapara, we can give a partial kapara, so we could possibly switch them, but theoretically we're trying to give the ideal kapara for this specific avera. So that's for the good of the sinner. And the third is for the good of the law. That's why the Bahag is going to say that every time you have an avera that's a chiyuv misa, so then you have that avera and you have another mitzvah to also protect that avera, give it status, by being willing to punish somebody who's going to violate it. So the Sanhedrin had all of these. And I think all these Rishonim would agree that the other elements are there also. The question is just what's the ikker, that each one's going to count the mitzvahs based on the ikker. Because Ramban's certainly going to agree that the kapara is part of it. He's just going to say that the main reason we do this is to protect society, and the kapara is also a part of it. And the Ramban might focus more on the kapara and decide to count for that reason. So in the context of the Sanhedrin, we have all of those. The Mishpat HaMelech is presumably just about protecting society. And din by b'nei Noach might also be just about protecting society, so we're going to have different rules. But when it comes to the Sanhedrin, so we have this full-blown kapara and everything that goes along with it, so then we have all these details that we have to have the two edim, and the two edim have to give the hasra, and the hasra has to be under perfect circumstances, and that's where we get all the details that are talked about here, a lot of which are talked about on our daf. So one of the details that's talked about on our daf is also the concept of yat asmo lemitzo, that this is one of the main reasons why it's very difficult to get executed in Beis Din. You really have to hire a very fancy lawyer to get yourself executed, because you need to have hasra. The hasra has to come from two kosher edim, and not only do they have to give you hasra, but they have to do so in such a way that you accept it. So we call yatur asma lemisa. You have to say, yes, I know what's going on, and I'm still willing to accept and go ahead with what I'm doing and take my punishment. So it's hard to find people who are going to do that. That's not such a likely kind of situation. But the idea of yatur asma lemisa, so somebody once wrote an article, I think this was also published around the time, and this was the whole discussion in the early days of the Medina, what the idea is of yatur asma lemisa. Why is it that you have to accept the Misa? So you could say it's a way of confirming that you're amazed. It's a way of confirming that you've actually gotten the Hasra. So some suggested there was another element here also, that it's about subjecting yourself to the authority of the Sanhedrin, of society. There was a debate in secular circles in the 1700s, I believe. There was a philosopher named Beccaria, Cesare Beccaria, who was an Italian philosopher who was very influential on some of the founding fathers of America, who a lot of them were opposed to the death penalty. The death penalty debate in America predates the establishment of the country, goes back to the colonies, and a lot of the founding fathers were not in favor. They were death penalty abolitionists, and some of them were influenced by this guy, Cesare Beccaria. So one of the arguments he made is that the only reason that government can do anything is because all the citizens get together and they aggregate their rights to the government, and they say the government can now function on our behalf. So he said, so therefore the death penalty is inherently immoral, because nobody would ever give the rights over to someone else to kill them. So therefore it must be that right doesn't exist, and the government doesn't have the right to kill. And other philosophers argued on this, and they said, no, it's not what it means. It doesn't mean that you have a checklist of which rights, you know, you're giving over to the government. It means that you're recognizing that the government has the authority to make the decisions, whatever they do have to do in order to keep society safe. And then whatever punishments they decide are necessary emerge from that. So too, he thought that's what the idea, I think it was Rabbi Reines who wrote this article, who said that that was the idea of Yatur Atzma Lemisa, that you acknowledge the authority of the Sanhedrin who's going to take whatever steps they need to take. But the whole process of Hasra, which is also one of the major themes here, is a difficult process to understand, that we see that the Gemara here talks about what the purpose of Hasra is, that there is a machlokus in the Gemara, first of all, whether a chaver requires Hasra. The Gemara here talks about a educated woman, the question of whether she needs Hasra in order to be executed. The assumption being, as the Gemara seems to tie the two together, that maybe if we say that the whole purpose is that Hasra is only there, lahavkin bein shogeg lemezid, to establish whether the person is shogeg or mezid, so then if somebody is knowledgeable, so then maybe we don't need Hasra. If somebody knows what the din of the Torah are, so then we don't need to give them Hasra. And maybe that should be the way the din is applied. So we have to figure out exactly what that means, because another requirement that you have for Hasra is that Hasra has to be tochidei dibur. Right, that if somebody gives you Hasra and tochidei dibur elapses before you do the Avera, so then the Hasra expires. How long is tochidei dibur? So it's a maximum of 9 seconds. So it means if 9 seconds pass, then you could, the Hasra expires. And Rashi explains in Ksuvos, it's because we're worried that maybe you forgot. Which is very hard to believe, right? You're about to kill someone, and two edim come and say to you, you realize if you kill this person, then you know you're going to be chayv misa, and you accept that. You say, yeah, I accept that. And then you go ahead and do it. And you say, what are you doing? I said, well, that was 30 seconds ago. You think I'm going to remember that Hasra? It's the Ktos HaChoshen has a very hard time with this. How could it be you're going to forget? One of the svarim that they published of Reb Zalman Nechemya Goldberg Shiurim, so he has a whole introduction, it has a Tefer Hilchos Eidos, I think. So he has a whole introduction where he talks about different ways to improve your memory and to remember what you learned. So he talks about this idea, is it possible that if the Torah Dibur, you're going to forget what you learned? It's hard to believe. So Rav Soloveitchik was known for explaining that it doesn't mean you're going to forget like you didn't know it in the first place. It means that the purpose of Hasra, when we talk about Shogeg Umezid, it doesn't just mean Mezid, that you're aware that there's such an Aveira and that there's an Onesh. It means that in order to be Chayiv Misa, and to actually get Misa, you have to be really incorrigible. You have to be somebody who's really, really lahachis. And therefore, the purpose of Hasra is to establish ad heichan hu parek ol. To what extent is somebody rebelling against the Torah in such a powerful way that not only does he know what he's doing is wrong, but he's thinking about it right now. He's thinking about how wrong it is as he's doing it. It's in his active consciousness, and he's still willing to violate it. That's a real incorrigible personality, and that's where the Zechiyah of Misa. And anything short of that, and some of the Achronim had a similar approach, and some of this debate that took place in the 50s and the 60s, they said that you see that we really have a very high threshold for who should really be Chayiv Misa. It's only somebody who really has no hope, who's so rebellious that he's willing to do an Aveira under those circumstances, that's where you're Chayiv Misa. But short of that, it's not the case. So it's interesting, the Rambam gets everybody upset because the Rambam paskins both things. The Rambam paskins that a Talmud Chacham does need Hasra, and that lo nitna Hasra lahafchem bin shogeg umezid. That here the Gemara seems to imply that it's the way around. That if the whole point of Hasra is to tell if you're a shogeg or mezid, then if you are a Talmud Chacham, then you shouldn't need it. And yet the Rambam paskin the Talmud Chacham does need Hasra, and that it's there to tell the difference between shogeg and mezid. So maybe you could say that maybe there is actually a machlokus among the Rishonim on this point, that maybe the Rambam understood Hasra is really there just to make sure the person knows what he's doing is wrong, that he is absolutely amazing. So a Talmud Chacham might not know because he might not be aware of the circumstances, or he might forget something. So you just have to confirm, check the box up or down, so even a Talmud Chacham might need that. But the other Rishonim maybe understand a little bit similar to what the Rav was saying, that you need Hasra not just to know yes or no or you show Giger Mezid, but also to see if you have some level of understanding of what you're doing and some level of understanding of why it's wrong. So you find this in Hilchos Shabbos, that there is a machlokas Rishon and Mechaschinuch has a whole discussion that when you give somebody Hasra for a Shabbos, if somebody's doing a malacha, so do you tell them that you should know you're doing a malacha and you're Chayiv Skila? Or do you have to do more than that? You have to identify the av malacha. You have to say that you're writing, that you're cooking, that you're planting. You have to identify what the malacha is. So some of the Rishonim seem to say like that, you have to identify the malacha. And the others say, why should that be? The Torah doesn't identify the malachas. The Torah just says, lo sasin ko malacha. So why should that take on different identities? That if somebody is doing any other avera, so it should be enough to just point to the pasuk and say you're violating this pasuk. We don't say if somebody's about to eat a cheeseburger and it's going to be chayav malchus, so you don't have to say it's a cheeseburger from McDonald's as opposed to a cheeseburger from Burger King. You should you just have to point to the isser. Why do you have to get so specific? So some of the Rishonim say you're right, you don't have to get so specific, but there are gemaras that sound like you do. And the reason the Gemara is talking, some of the Gemaras in all of Masechah Shabbos, when the Gemara talks about any malacha, and the Gemara says, well, what malacha is it? Is this malacha, that malacha? So it's all through the entire Masechah Shabbos, you have those discussions. So some of the Rishonim understand the whole reason we're trying to figure out what malacha it is because we want to know what kind of hasra to give. So it sounds like you do have to mention the av malacha when you give hasra. So some Rishonim say, well, no, you don't really have to. It's just that if you give the wrong one, the guy will think you're joking. He'll think you're making fun of him. He won't take it seriously. So it's always okay to leave out the av malacha, but if you choose to put it in, then you have to get it right. And others suggest that maybe there's something when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos that we have a concept of havara l'chalek yotzos, that the Torah does identify one malacha by name, lo sevar reish b'chol mosh l'seichem v'yom ha-shabbos, and according to one opinion, that creates what's known as chiluk malachas. The malachas are all distinct from each other for at least korban purposes. So some Rishonim understand that all the malachas have independent identities. So it's as if there are 39 malachas written out in the Torah, even though that's not the case. It's ki'ilu, that is the case. So that being the case, that's why you should treat it differently than other Yisurim. It should get its own identity. But you could say a little differently also. You could say that when it comes to malachas, people don't really understand what a malacha is. The Torah says don't do a malacha, and they don't know that writing something on a piece of paper is called a malacha. They don't know that planting something in the ground is called a malacha. So if Hasra requires not only that you should be shogeg or mezid, but that you should have a better understanding of what it is, so maybe Shabbos is different than other areas of the Torah. There's a need to actually explain why what they're doing is violating the Torah, and therefore you have to identify the malacha. To support that point, the Bital Ashkenazi in his Chuvas, he says the only malacha that you have to identify for Hasra purposes is Hotzah, which would make sense that Hotzah, some of the Rishonim explain, is called a lousy malacha, malacha grua, because people tend to not be aware that it's a real malacha. They don't understand that carrying is anything so terrible. So that would support this idea that the purpose of Hasra is also they should understand the significance of what they're doing. So maybe in Halacha Shabbos in general, it's hard for people to relate to how an action is a malacha, but especially with Hotzah, it doesn't seem like a malacha, so therefore there's a greater need to spell it out. So it could be that that's what's going on. You have Hasra, that maybe that's a part of the purpose of Hasra also, to confirm the person is Shogeg or Mezid, but also that they have some level of understanding what's going on. What else is on this daf? So one point that's not specifically relevant to Mises Bezdin, but the idea of Mil Sadasi V'Kal V'Chomer Tarech V'Kasev L'Akra, that it's an interesting idea that the Gemara seems to suggest that there are some things we could learn from a Kal V'Chomer, and yet, nonetheless, Torah took the effort to write it out as a pasuk. And the Gemara takes that for granted, that that's something that makes sense. That even though we could have known this anyway, so the Torah takes the space to write it out. So why should that be? If the Torah is so careful not to waste words, so why should we write something out if it could have been derived from a Kal V'Chomer? So the Briska Rab has a comment in his Sefer Maseches Erchin, if I remember correctly, and others point this out as well, that apparently we see that there are different levels of severity, and that even though that which is derived from the Midos Shatar Nidrashas Behem, that's still considered to be Min HaTorah, it's still considered to be on that level of authority, but there's still distinctions within. And something that is Beferish and Chumash is considered to be more authoritative than something that's not Beferish and Chumash. And therefore, if it's learned out from a Kal V'Chomer, so that's one level of din, but if it's written in a Pasuk, it's going to have greater severity, and that's why the Torah might write something even if it could be derived from a Kal V'Chomer. On the other hand, the Gemara elsewhere suggests that a Svara is so powerful that it doesn't need a Pasuk. Sometimes the Gemara will say, in the context of Hamotzi Mechaver or Lavaraya, and other things, the Gemara sometimes has an expression, Lama Likra Svarahu, that why should I need a Pasuk? It's obvious, it's a logical point. So apparently it seems to suggest that if something is a svara, so then there's no point in writing the pasuk. It wouldn't be any stronger because it was spelled out in the pasuk. So you also have to assume that there's different madrigas of svara, that svara that's absolutely rock solid, and that could be authoritative on the level of a pasuk, but there are svaras which are a little bit less obvious, and they might still be true, but if they were written in a pasuk, they would have a greater status and some kind of a hierarchy here.
In terms of that Torah didn't need to be Makadish if it was indeed a Svara. So, according to them, how
would
you understand Torah?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So, they seem to be opposing points, right? They seem to be, on the one hand, Lama Likra Svara, who sounds like a Svara doesn't need a Pasuk, wouldn't be anything added, because that would be the answer. I need a Pasuk because the Pasuk makes it stronger. So apparently it sounds like the Pasuk doesn't make it any stronger. And here, Tarech V'Kasuk L'Akra sounds like the Pasuk does make it stronger. So the difference could be, it just could be a matter of degree, that not all Svaras are equal. That and we wouldn't say by every Svar that that it's considered. The Gemara also uses that expression, for example, by Brachos. And so we don't necessarily assume L'Halacha that Brachos are considered to be Din D'Oraisa, Brachos on food. So you have to figure out exactly when you rise to the level of an absolute glatt svara that is considered to be an actual din min haTorah. And apparently there are other things which are svaras also, but are not so rock solid that they don't need a little bit of help. So apparently the expression is used in different degrees, and what you'd have to say probably is that there are certain svaras that could rise to the level of derisa if they're so absolute. And then there are other things which we could figure out through the Gimel Midas HaShatar Nidrashas Baham, which would also have a status of derisa, but would be stronger if it was spelled out in a pasuk, and if there was a clash, it wouldn't necessarily factor in so much. Okay.
More powerful meaning?
It means probably that if there's a conflict between two dinim, then the din that's spelled out in Chumash is going to have greater authority than the din that's not spelled out in Chumash. That you probably have to weigh in the clash between the two a greater priority for the one that's actually spelled out. Right, so you have to assume that that not all svaras are equal. See, are there any other concepts to pick up here? It's interesting also, you know, the Gemara talks about the Hasra from Mekoshe Sheitzim. The Gemara talks about where you learn a Hasra, and one of the possible sources of Hasra is Mekoshe Sheitzim. So it's interesting to note that there is a whole discussion about how the Mekoshe Sheitzim could get Hasra. Because in general, there is an opinion in the Gemara elsewhere that the Mekoshe Sheitzim actually was well-meaning. That we're not even sure what Malach Mekoshe Sheitzim did. That was a machlok in the Gemara also. Was he in violation of Ma'amir? Was he in violation? So that's also a good question as far as Hasra B'Shem Ha'av. You know, you think this Gemara should talk about that here. What not only the Makar for Hasra, but what Hasra did they give him? So Mekoshe is not one of the Lamatas Malachas. So what was the Malach that he was over? But the Gemara also suggests that maybe he didn't want to do it because he wanted to be Mechal Shabbos, that he felt that he had to teach a lesson, that he wanted to support Shabbos, and that people were starting to forget about it, so therefore he was Moser Nefesh, which is not something we recommend trying at home, but he felt that this was the Tzarech HaShah, that he should be Moser Nefesh in order to take on this message that Shabbos should be protected. So some raise the question, the Kedushas Levi has this question, the Rashash also has this question, that it would seem like if that's what he's doing, so he's motivated by something else other than the malach itself, shouldn't we call that a malach shein etzrichu legufa? That was the whole discussion. In general, Tosfos understands that concept of malach shein etzrichu legufa, that you're pater on Shabbos, that means that you're doing a malach for a reason other than the reason it was done in the Mishkan. So some Achronim built onto that, and they thought that it means that not just that you're doing the malach itself for a different reason, but that your motivation to do the whole action is something else. Let's say, for example, somebody's forcing you to, or you're doing it in order to accomplish some other goal, even though you want to do the malacha, but you're doing the malacha itself for a different reason other than the reason people normally do it, so then that's called a malacha shenetzrich legufa. So some thought in Mekoshe Sheitzim, it should be a problem that maybe it's a problem of malacha shenetzrich legufa, he shouldn't have been executed. He should have been pater, which was another reason not to try this at home. It's kind of a self-defeating plan if the whole plan is to do this and they end up getting executed. So I think the Kedushas Levi asked this question and leaves it b'tzarchin. And the others asked this question and they say, yeah, it was a malach shein etzrich legufa, but they didn't know that. They thought he was just being Mekoshe Sheitzim for his own enjoyment. And therefore, they gave him normal hasra, normal execution, because nobody knew it was a malach shein etzrich legufa. So that's a whole question. How exactly do you give Hasra in light of the fact that maybe as far as you can tell, the action might be a malach shein etzrich legufa, and therefore maybe it's what we call a Hasra suffix. The Gemara normally says that if you're giving a Hasra and you don't know that the Aveira, whatever it is actually going to happen, so then that's called a Hasra suffix, and Hasra is no good. So maybe we don't know. The person's doing a malacha. We don't know if he's doing a malacha for his own sake or he's doing a malach shein etzrich legufa. So how can you give Hasra under some circumstances? The Klausenberger Rebbe has a tshuva about this, and his tshuva is Divrei Yatziv, where he suggests that maybe that's the reason that there's a machlokis in the first place about whether Malach Shein Etzrichu Legufa is pater, and the opinion in the Gemara that he's chayiv, that Malach Shein Etzrichu Legufa is chayiv, the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, which is also the way the Rambam paskins against all the other Rishonim, that Malach Shein Etzrichu Legufa is chayiv. So maybe that's why, because otherwise you can't have a Hasra, because you're going to always have to worry that maybe the person's not doing the Malacha for Legufa reasons. So the fact that we know that Chil Shabbos can bring about a Chiyuv Misa, that shows you that you have to be able to give Hasra, and that shows that Hasra has to be able to exist despite the concern of Malach Shein Etzrichu Legufa. Now, you could say that maybe it's not such a question, that maybe, first of all, maybe that's part of what the Eidim will clarify, and that's maybe also where the Yatr Atzmo L'Misa comes in. The individual will also clarify that. And also, not every Malacha has a Malacha Shein Etzrichu Legufa version. It could be that the Malachas were at Shaykh, so then we'll have to figure it out. But the Malachas were it's not Shaykh, so that's where you'll have a Chiyuv Misa. But that was a part of the discussion, and here we see the Mekoshe Sheitzim himself, which the Gemara quotes as one of the sources for Hasra, so you have to figure out whether he himself was even eligible for Hasra, or was he even eligible for the Chiyuv Misa if he was involved in a Malacha Shein Etzrichu Legufa. Okay, any other major topics to pick up on this daf? You know, the Gemara talks about this difference between Bedikos and Chakiros, and about the assumption that the murder weapon is something that's very significant, and that's something you can't get wrong, but other details maybe you could get wrong. So that goes back and forth about what kind of details are going to be included in that. And the Gemara talks about why it's okay for the Edom to be off by one day when figuring out the date. So one possibility is that maybe there was an Ibra Chodesh and one knew about it and one didn't know about it. So therefore they have different calculations. They both saw it on Tuesday, but one thought Tuesday was the 4th and one thought Tuesday was the 5th because one knew about the Ibra Chodesh and one didn't. So the Gemara has a discussion here that maybe, okay, up until halfway through the month we could say that. But eventually it becomes harder to say that because after you have halfway through the month, then you have to assume people already know, which is all relevant to Rosh Hashanah. And I like the fact that even in Eretz Yisrael, we have 2 days Rosh Hashanah because the beginning of the month, so people don't necessarily know what's going on later on in the month. It's already harder to say people don't know. And the Gemara says in this context, this is also irrelevant to Rosh Hashanah. The Gemara says that part of how people would know is they would blow shofar, so they would hear about the shofar, so they would know if there was something going on with Kiddush HaChodesh. So the Rishonim discuss why they did this. It's not necessarily clear that this is an inherent part of the Kiddush HaChodesh process, that there should be a blowing of the shofar. So it seems to be that the chashivas of the moment, that when there are major events, so they would blow the shofar. So we know we just had the most major events when the shofar is blown. But in general, we have a theme that throughout Jewish life, when something is a big deal, we blow the shofar. We remember those of us who were in Washington last week, blew the shofar there. To capture the kotel, right? That, you know, certain major events. So we blow the shofar. So apparently, Kiddush HaChodesh, that was an idea also, that the shofar was blown to accompany that. All right, there's also Kiddush Levana here, which is a pretty big sugya, but it's mostly on Mem Beis, and Mem Beis, whoever's saying the Shir on Mem Beis next week, only gets one Amud, so I don't want to take away from that. So most of the Kiddush Levana sugya is on Mem Beis, so we'll allow him to discuss that. So I guess we'll stop here. Wish everyone a wonderful Shabbat Shuvah. You should have continued Hatzlacha in finishing this parak and in full advantage of all the learning opportunities Yeshiva has here for this wonderful opportunity for Sarasimei Tshuva to be a very intense spiritual experience, and it should be a Gemar Chesima Tova for everybody. Shkach.